Good morning. It's 8:59. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up in about 2 minutes, it's Teresa Mitchell. Her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. Press Watch. At 10 o'clock, it's the Heather McCoy Show. Heather has as her topic the new bill before Congress that broadens the definition of domestic terrorists that could be used to censor protests of dissent. So joining Heather to discuss the implications of this proposed bill will be civil rights lawyer and 2020 candidate for the 10th District, Michael Siegel. At 11 o'clock, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman welcomes Brandon Shimoda, an American of Japanese descent. He talks about his family being an enemy of the state during World War II in his book, The Grave on the Wall. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Press Watch is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Again, that's Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. So, top of the news you're not supposed to know, Antonio Zamora has been arrested for felony riot. Antonio is someone who shows up. He showed up for Occupy ICE. He's showed up against the concentration camp horror that this nation has been going through. And his apartment has been rifled through by police, and he's been released on bail. Now, felony riot in Oregon is a vague law instituted in 2017 in Oregon, and I didn't know how vague it was until I actually read it today. It reads, a person commits the crime of riot if, while participating with five or more other persons, the person engages in tumultuous and violent conduct and thereby intentionally or recklessly creates a grave risk of causing public alarm. A risk of causing public alarm. Now, I had heard that, and it's a Class C felony. Now, I know that some of the Patriot Prayer men had been arrested on this charge, and I assumed that it was because they were rioting. In other words, they went to Cider Riot and caused a fracas. Punches were thrown. Someone got really severely hurt during that whole thing, and that's a riot. Apparently, riot in Oregon is just creating a risk of causing public alarm. A risk of causing public alarm. Five or more persons. Now, by that definition, I have certainly engaged in felony riot time and again for the last couple of, well, for a generation here. And so have many of you. So this law has got to be repealed. It is, as I was saying, ORS 166.015, if you want to look it up online. Now, according to a Facebook post, the Civil Liberties Defense Center may be taking an interest in the case, which is currently set for trial September 11th. Speaking for myself, Antonio Zamora is a righteous man who's taken a loud and justified public stand against the criminality of this late capitalist culture. Antonio has been on the front lines against the concentration camps and the Trump-supported fascist invasions of Portland. He deserves our support. Speculation online has been that Mayor Ted Wheeler may be behind this arrest in an attempt to appear neutral between the Portland left and the fascist right. So there's going to be more on this. I understand Old Mole may cover this on Monday. So stay tuned to KBOO Radio for more information. Of course, we have our news programs as well. The court case is number 19CR5664. 19CR5664. DA case number 240-8338, citation, criminal mischief 2, a misdemeanor, felony riot, a class C felony, disorderly conduct, a class B misdemeanor. Zero bail is listed, and he is listed as released at this time. So again, Antonio Zamora, who you may know from many protests, has been arrested for felony riot after his apartment was attacked and rifled through by police. The number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. And I'll go to the first caller, Edie. Hi, Edie. What's up?
Good morning. I've known Antonio since Occupy Portland, and I trust, respect, admire, and love the guy. I'll put my life in front of bullets to protect him. He is a skilled and graceful de-escalator, calming people on left or right, cops. He is not violent. He does not cause alarm or harm, but the police and the fascists out of uniform do, and Wheeler's policies and statements cause alarm. But Antonio causes inspiration and calm and safety and community and democracy and self-discipline, and is the ideal, the opposite of what they are claiming. And I got the impression that, okay, if we're going to be forced into have to do something for some patriot care and bad guys, then we'll just have some token, going against some people on the left. They always arrest and beat up and falsely accuse some on the left than on the right.
So you think it's a political gesture?
I think it is, because it's across the board, from folks with backbone campaign action camp, and all the good things that they're going to promote justice to immigrant justice, to climate justice, to worker rights, there's a wide range of wonderful causes and needed social change that he represents and inspires people in. And so attacking him is a way to attack many different groups across the board and exploit racism, etc., LGBTQI, homophobia, whatever it is, that there's a way in which people can target him as a way to target some of the others. And I see it actually as an act of terrorism to wrongly arrest him, make a big deal about him.
Do you think it's an attempt to intimidate the left generally?
Yeah, and I'm seeing all this publicity against him, vilifying him, instead of letting us know about the real bad guys, and how to protect ourselves from them. And holding city and police accountable for those harms. And I really think that this is an opportunity for all of us to rise in unity, community and love, and integrity. Watch our security culture that's not paranoia, but it's more effective. And let's rise the occasion and show that we're done, that we... thank you, KBU. Thank you, Teresa Mitchell. Can make a creative festival and some solid lawsuits and legislation and city ordinances and community rapid response teams to use this opportunity to make it better for all of us, and especially for the dearest beloved Antonio.
Well, I think that's where Antonio's coming from. He's trying to make a society that's better for all of us. Thanks so much for calling in. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. 8187. And as I was saying, Antonio Zamora has been arrested for felony riot. And the felony riot is law in Oregon is so vague. It says a person commits the crime of riot if, while participating with five or more other persons, the person engages in tumultuous and violent conduct and thereby intentionally or recklessly creates a grave risk of causing public alarm. Doesn't say anything about harm to persons or even harm to property. It's just a risk of causing public alarm. And that is such a vague law that it is essentially, in my opinion, an anti-dissent law. I mean, how are we to express ourselves, especially outside the severely constricted electoral system? The corporate-owned politicians that we have to go to the streets and express ourselves and do so loudly and on numerous occasions. And it seems to me, as I was saying, this risk of causing alarm, well, that's pretty subjective. And that would certainly apply to me and maybe to you. So the number to call, 503-231-8187. Now, I have some other headlines. You can call in and you can talk about this topic if you like. And if I have time today, I want to talk about collective action. But first, I want to say that on Tuesday, CNN reported that corporate insiders have sold off an average of $600 million worth of stock every day in August, likely marking, they write, the fifth month of 2019 in which insider selling exceeds $10 billion. First time this has happened since 2007, which preceded a severe financial crisis and recession. Now, according to a CNBC article from 2017, 67% of 24-year-olds have less than $1,000 in savings. This is not news to you listening to me, I'm sure. I mean, who's got $1,000? And only 44% of millennials generally can make it 3 months without a paycheck. So a recession would hit that demographic hard on top of the life of recession they've already received. People who came of age after the recession of 2007-2008 are just going to be slammed by a further collapse. So I find this news alarming. I mean, it would be anyway. We've got enough people living on the streets as it is, not able to make rents. It's just a simple equation. The rents are too freaking high and the wages are too freaking low and there aren't enough jobs. And that brings up the Green New Deal, which I may get to later in the broadcast. Again, number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Antonio Zamora has been arrested. His apartment rifled through, the charges extremely vague. From Radio Havana, Cuba, the Washington Post is reporting President Donald Trump has ordered his staff to speed up the construction of his border wall before the 2020 election, even if it means breaking the law. Trump reportedly told aides he will pardon them if they face any legal repercussions related to the request, which could include seizing private land, expediting billions of dollars of construction contracts, and ignoring environmental regulations. Now, this speaking for myself, this is obstruction of justice. Saying that you're going to pardon people for breaking the law is obstruction of justice, and it is a fascist power grab. According to the Washington Post story, returning to the Radio Havana, Cuba article, Trump dismissed concerns over the implications of circumventing appropriate procedures, including by using eminent domain, telling staffers to just take the land. The quote is, take the land. And I've got Kendall on the air, and the number to call, 503-231-8187. Hi, Kendall.
Hi, how are you, Teresa?
Doing well, thanks.
I am so glad that you're doing a story about Antonio Zamora. Like Edie, I have known him since 2011. I met him during the original Occupy Wall Street in Portland. And what a wonderful young man he is. He is upright, he is generous, he is honest, he is kind. And back in 2011, he asked me if I could teach meditation to activists. And that's what got me started with regenerating the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in Portland. And we are all grateful to him as being the individual person who brought to our attention the fact that public meditation could be a useful way to make a protest. So we are very grateful to him, and we think of him as being one of our founders. Locally.
Well, that's really interesting, because that really has made a mark on the the Buddhist Peace Fellowship has been very visible and active and constant, particularly in confronting the concentration camp phenomenon.
We have, but we started because of Antonio Zamora.
How about that?
And I just want to take the focus back to him. He did a lot of traveling on foot in Central and South America, and he encountered some Hindu meditators there, and he himself has been a meditator for many years. He is a very peaceful, caring person.
Yeah, I remember at one point he was going to try to cross the jungle into Venezuela, and I thought, geez, this guy is fearless.
Yes. No, he has done that. He did it.
Wow.
And he came back, and he meant to do it again. He's very interested in a concept called earthships, which I don't understand very much about, but he cares very much about ecology and about the healthy climate that we live in. And he's just really an activist for goodness and kindness and peace.
And the price that he has paid is that the cops have raided his apartment.
I know.
Terrifying his housemates, tossing the place.
Absolutely.
And is being charged with this stuff.
Yeah, I agree with Edie that this is terrorism. The police, in doing that to him, in breaking down the door of the house where he lived, in ransacking the apartment, have terrorized him and his housemates to some extent. I think they are resilient. I think they're going to be fine. I think they have rallied behind him. But the purpose of the whole thing was to frighten leftists and to dampen protest, and it makes me furious.
J. Edgar Hoover is reincarnated, and his name is Ted Wheeler.
You got it. Yes.
Well, thanks for calling
in,
Kendall.
You. Thanks. Okay, bye.
All right, we've heard from Edie and Kendall. Been talking about, and I'm outraged, actually, that Antonio Zamora has been arrested in this way and charged with these vague and powerful charges. Felonies are not to be scoffed at. I was arrested on a felony back in 06 for yelling at a business owner who had threatened my job and then threatened me with a gun. Basically, I was arrested for being an uppity tranny. And it cost me. It cost me, all told, I'd say around $10,000 in lost wages and expenses and interest for the money that I had to take out to confront it. So Antonio is going to need your help, certainly, to confront these bogus charges. Now returning to headlines, again from Radio Havana, Cuba, U.S. activists in solidarity with Venezuela have issued a news release detailing information on the four who were arrested by U.S. authorities in May at Venezuela's embassy in Washington, D.C. And before I read more on this, you will recall that the government of Venezuela invited these people in. They were there legitimately by international agreement and authority. That was Venezuelan territory. All embassies are the territory of their respective countries. And, well, I'll return to the press release. The newly formed Embassy Protectors Defense Committee, created in response to the arrest and bogus charges leveled by the Trump administration against the last four remaining activists of the Embassy Protective Collective that occupied the Venezuela embassy for 37 days, has launched an international campaign to demand that the Trump administration drop all federal charges against the protectors. The last remaining four embassy protectors, Kevin Zeese, Margaret Flowers, David Powell, and Adrian Pine, were arrested in the Washington, D.C. embassy of Venezuela on May 16, 2019, having occupied the Venezuela embassy with as many as other 100 other activists with the permission of the Venezuelan government over the course of those 37 days. The Embassy Protection Collective was welcomed into the Venezuelan embassy in order to prevent it from being illegally taken by the unelected regime of Juan Guaido that was being imposed on the Venezuelan people by the Trump administration. The four are now facing misdemeanor charges of interfering with certain protective functions of the federal government that carries a maximum of 1 year imprisonment and a $100,000 fine for each of them. The U.S. government is intent on making an example of these citizens and is using its unlimited resources to make sure that they are penalized and incarcerated. The Embassy Protectors Defense Committee, made up of a collection of human rights defenders, international law experts, journalists, labor activists, anti-war, and social justice activists, social justice advocates, is involved in raising resources to help cover the enormous expenses of defending against the bogus charge and the outrageous fines The government appears intent on imposing if the charges are not dropped and the case proceeds to trial. This is a politicized case initiated by an administration that is unrestrained by accepted international law and recognized state relations as a part of the international order established over the last seven decades. The Embassy Defense Committee is circulating a petition and launching a massive international campaign to have all charges dropped and to compel the Trump administration to re-enter the community of law-abiding states. For more information, visit, and then it gives the URL, which is defendembassyprotectors.org, defendembassyprotectors.org. And again, that was from Radio Havana, Cuba. I've been talking about the arrest and bogus charges leveled against a selected Portland activist, Antonio Zamora. I've been expressing my outrage about that. Number to call is 503-231-8187, and Harry is next.
Oh, greetings, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Who they need to arrest for riot is Lars Larson, because he lives up in Washington, and his brown shirts, who are the Patriots pair and the other group, well, they're his brown shirts. He's causing all them to come here.
So you're saying he's inciting to riot?
Yes, he's inciting. He's the one inciting to riot.
And so Lars Larson is a commentator on, a local radio
KXL.
Station. KXL, thank you.
Yeah, he's on KXL. And so he's the one causing all this. I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, he was having demonstrations at Portland State. And he's the one causing all this. And when he comes across the bridge to go to work at KXL, he needs to be arrested and charged with the same charges of what type of riot was this?
This charge is from an Oregon state law, which says that you are, I'll read it again, a person commits the crime of riot if, while participating with five or more other persons, a person engages in tumultuous and violent conduct and thereby intentionally or recklessly creates a grave risk of causing public alarm, Class C felony. And as I was saying, I had no idea that the law was that vague. It was applied to the Patriot Prayer people who caused harm at the cider riot, ironically named place, where one may riotously drink ciders. I thought, that was a riot, so they were charged with riot. But then now I see that this law is extremely vague. I mean, it creates a grave risk of causing public alarm. I mean, anyone can become alarmed.
Yeah,
I'm sure people
true.
Have become
that's
alarmed
true.
At my loud voice when I'm at protests. I'm shockingly loud.
That's why they should charge Lars Larson with this, because the Patriot Prayer and everything, they're his brown shirts. He wants he can never win an election, so he's a very rich. He's worth multi-millions of dollars, and he wants power, and this is how he gets his power.
Well, now that's an interesting tack that you're taking there, because under U.S. federal law, a riot is defined a person is guilty of inciting to riot when one urges 10 or more persons to engage in tumultuous and violent conduct of a kind likely to create public alarm. Oh, I see where they got this. I see where they got this verbiage now. So, if Antonio is arrested for riot, then I see your point under federal law, and it would be federal because Lars is creating something that is interstate in nature. He's getting those people to come over from Vancouver and from all around the country into Portland.
Yeah, that's true. So that's who they need to really go after. My next question is about the Amazon fires. And I've been hearing Amazon fires. They've never said when did it start. Are these wildfires, or are these people actually setting these fires? And I haven't heard of any like satellite imaging to see how bad this smoke really is.
Well, I've read a little bit about it. And I understand that the fires were deliberately set by farmers who were eager to make a political statement that they should be allowed to take as much land as they wished for cattle grazing.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. So, but is this, like, Amazon's a pretty big area. Is this the West Amazon, East Amazon, South Amazon, North Amazon? Where exactly these fires are, And they don't really explain and how long they've been doing it. Example, if these fires are going on the equator and the smoke on the equator, well, it's going to cause the whole planet to cool. So is that why Oregon's strawberry crop was ruined this year, because it was wet and damp when normally it isn't? And can Oregon sue Brazil for their strawberry crop being ruined?
Huh. I don't know. I'm looking at a map now of the fires in the Amazon, and they are south of the Amazon River, and they are extremely extensive. They cover pretty much all of South America south of the Amazon, and they're very heavy in the center of South America. There are many in Bolivia and in Brazil, so...
Well, this is part of the Amazon. Is it burning there also?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So a huge portion of the Amazon is burning. I think I understand what you're saying, that the reporting should be more focused.
Yeah, it isn't. And like you know, most of the time what they do is they cut down the timber, they sell the timber, then they slash and burn. But this seems to be they're burning the whole jungle. They're burning everything, not saving anything, just want to clear the land.
Yeah, and there are fires every year, but this year is much worse than before. And there is the political angle of essentially the fascists supporting Bolsonaro by saying, screw everything, we're just going to burn our way into profits.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, hey, thank you for taking my call.
Good questions. Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Now, I started today's broadcast by talking about Antonio Zamora, who has been arrested. His apartment invaded overnight, a couple nights ago, and earlier this week anyway, and has been charged under this felony riot, which, as you heard from the first two callers, is a ridiculous idea applied to him. He does engage in peaceful protests. I'm sure that they're loud at times. It's just absurd to think that he is being charged with the same law that is being applied to the bullies who come into town and beat people and who brag about their beating. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Now, I wanted to talk about... let's see. I got a note in. Edie called back and said we should show support for OregonDAForThePeople.com. OregonDAForThePeople.com. So I just want to pass that on. Now, a little history. This is from an article by Matthew Wills in jstor.org, which is a resource for journalists. In 1963, the three main nuclear powers signed the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, banning nuclear tests in the atmosphere and outer space and underwater. The USSR, the UK, and the US allowed themselves to continue underground tests. Most other nations, nuclear powers or not, would ultimately sign the treaty. The big exceptions were France and China, who continued atmospheric testing until 1968 and 1980, respectively. Since the US began hydrogen bomb testing in 1952, enormous amounts of fallout had been released around the world. Just before the partial ban was signed in August 1963, both sides of the Cold War went on an orgy of atmospheric testing, 200 bombs during 1961 and 62. The treaty ended nearly a decade of hydrogen bomb testing. The equivalent of more than 7,100 Hiroshima-sized bombs were detonated at Bikini and Eniwetok atolls. The radioactive isotopes created and released by all these tests became the first environmental pollutant to take on the dimensions of a global threat, according to historian Laura A. Bruno. Ironically, research into the radiation released into the atmosphere and from there into the soil, water, plants, and animals, including humans, during the 1950s reign of fallout provided the basis for our understanding of pathways of persistent chemicals in the environment. Bruno writes, as a result of fallout, scientists learned that pollutants could travel over long periods and distances, and they could be accumulated in a reservoir in organic matter. This research revealed how interconnected different ecosystems are and led to the view that our global environment cannot tolerate endless pollutants. And I think we just heard that reflected in our discussion about the Amazon fires. Returning to the article, before World War II's Manhattan Project, the American effort to build an atomic bomb, there was little knowledge about how radioactive and other chemical particles dispersed. During the war, German rivers and air were sampled for xenon-133, an isotope produced in reactors, and none was found. Radioactive dust from the Trinity test site in Nevada in July 1945 and the explosions of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were found to girdle the Earth. A month after the first Trinity test, the Kodak Company discovered that paper made from Indiana corn husks was contaminated with radiation. It made little streaks on the paper. One of the more dangerous isotopes was strontium-90, which is produced in large amounts by atmospheric test. Because it is chemically similar to calcium, animals readily absorbed it. In human bodies, it remains active for anywhere from days to decades. The atmosphere, soil, grass, cattle, cow's milk, human pathway was particularly evocative for the early anti-nuclear campaigners, since the developing bones of children absorbed even more than of this radioactive poison, which can cause bone marrow, and other cancers than adults. Now, the reason I'm reading this is I'm setting the stage. The fact is, the bomb was banned, but at the time, it seemed that it was an impossible task. I mean, the bombs themselves were terrifying. And it was conducted within the framework of, oh, we have to absolutely intimidate the communists or they'll kill us all. That radiation was almost certainly the doom of my childhood friend Becky. Becky Bentle, she broke her arm playing in her front yard, but did not notice the pain. It was bizarre, so she's taken to the doctor, and it turns out she had a strontium-typical bone cancer. And I remember her trying to stay cheerful as she died, selecting a wig as her hair fell out from chemotherapy. She got to be 12 years old, and she died. And if you were born in the 50s and 60s, your life may yet be shortened by the radioactive fallout poison. But the fallout was ended. The 1954 Bravo test, returning to that article at Bikini Atoll, brought fallout to the attention of the world because it poisoned Marshallese Islanders, American military personnel, and the crew of a Japanese fishing boat. The Atomic Energy Commission, whose studies of the effects on nuclear war in plants and particularly animals was initially classified, admitted that radioactive isotopes could spread globally and enter the human food chain. The awareness that radioactive poisons in the atmosphere ended up in all living things became the basis for the environmental movement. Bruno notes that the equivalent of those bombs were detonated at, birds, fish, and plants were maimed or burnt to death at those atolls as whole coral atolls were obliterated. But it's collective action that saved the day. And collective action is what the Sanders campaign is offering with the Green New Deal. Collective action on a huge scale. It is a premise that the entire society could mobilize as it did in World War II to stop the colossus, the juggernaut of accelerating climate change. So some more details on how this was done, how this collective action was brought about. There was a certain amount of propaganda involved, and I mean propaganda in the good sense, bringing out information and emphasizing it until people got to talking about it, and it was journalists that did it. There's an article, How to Stop a Nuclear Bomb, the St. Louis Baby Tooth Survey. It's by Rosalind Early in St. Louis Magazine. I'm going to quote some of that. In 1951, the first nuclear test explosion at the Nevada test site had flashed so bright a mail truck driver in Orderville, Utah, thought Russians had nuked Los Angeles. A cloud of fallout 300 miles wide blossomed almost instantly and then blew away on an easterly wind. Though neighboring areas saw it in pink clouds, the radioactive fallout mostly stayed in the air and came down invisible and tasteless as precipitation. It came down as rain. In 1953, skipping ahead, a series of weapon tests included dirty blasts, combining radioactive material with typical explosives. Speaking for myself, they used to be really, really crazy about this sort of thing, and it's because they weren't called out on it. Returning to the article, a quarter of the sheep in Utah and Nevada died within months. Concerned farmers called the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, which ran the nuclear program. Investigators discovered that the sheep's gastrointestinal tracts showed high levels of radiation. The commission claimed the sheep died from malnutrition, however, and the testing went on. But then, speaking for myself, there was collective action. Now, returning to this article, she writes, during the run-up to the 1956 presidential election, Democratic candidate Adlai Stevenson spoke about the dangers of radioactive elements and fallout, particularly strontium-90, a metal with a half-life of 30 years. The body metabolizes it like calcium, making it especially harmful to infants and toddlers. Stevenson called it the most dreadful poison in the world, though the Illinois governor lost to General Dwight Eisenhower that November for the presidency. fallout had become a major concern to the rest of the nation. The next year, Nobel Prize-winning chemist Linus Pauling visited Washington University to speak about fallout's dangers. While there, he drafted a petition demanding a ban on nuclear testing as a first step towards multilateral disarmament. 9,000 scientists eventually signed it, and Pauling presented it to the United Nations in January 1958. Washington University faculty members also took action. Botanist Barry Commoner and other professors, as well as concerned citizens, formed the Greater St. Louis Citizens Committee for Nuclear Information, or the CNI. And what this article doesn't say is that the press reported all of that, and people were talking about it because the press was bringing out articles in a continuous stream about this phenomenon. And this is why KBOO is so important to you when it comes to these issues that at first especially are essentially excluded from the press, essentially excluded from mainstream discussion. KBOO radio, which depends on your contributions for 70% of its income, is absolutely essential. You can't get this information out to the mainstream press without first priming the pump with, you know, people discussing it from community radio. This has happened over and over, and this was true during the fallout struggle as well. It depended on journalism getting the word out, and journalism used to be a different thing. But now you have KBOO, you have Pacifica Radio, and it depends on you caring about it, and you know, you thinking of yourself as part of the society and contributing. KBOO.fm is where you can contribute right now if you'd like. But returning to the article, what they really wanted was to find out how much strontium-90 was getting into our bodies, but testing required bone samples, which were hard to get in large numbers. Then Herman Kalkar, a scientist at National Institutes of Health, suggested using baby teeth. St. Louis was an ideal place to begin the study. The U.S. Public Health Service had been monitoring radioactive elements in the air, water, and milk samples in 9 different cities since 1956. St. Louis topped the list for having the highest levels of strontium-90 in milk, tainted by dairy cows grazing on grass covered in radioactive material. With almost $200,000 from the National Institute of Dental Research and support from the schools of dentistry at both Washington University and St. Louis University, the St. Louis Baby Tooth Survey was ready to begin. And it goes on to talk about Eric Rice and his mother, Dr. Louise Rice, who is essential. His father was a Jewish refugee from Austria, and he says he was painfully aware of how things could go wrong and understood the dangers of keeping your mouth shut. And I'm going to skip ahead on this article because what it describes is the women's effort to get those teeth to the scientists and to reveal what they already knew, that health was being affected by this radioactive crap that was being spread by the extensive nuclear bomb testing, something unimaginable today. Unimaginable because collective action was taken. This wasn't a matter of people, you know, being virtuous and deciding to only use powdered milk or something like that. This is something that we all had to do together, and it was backed off with the information that came from the teeth and from the women's Ban the Bomb effort. By the end of 1959, volunteers had collected more than 14,000 teeth, she writes, and Louise was running tests. Since strontium-90 levels in an individual are too small to be measured, the teeth were batched according to criteria such as age, neighborhood, and duration of breastfeeding. By 1961, the survey was collecting 750 teeth a week. That year, Louise published her findings in the peer-reviewed journal Science. A simple chart told the story. Children born in 1954 had 4 times as much strontium-90 in their teeth as those born in 1951. And quoting Louise, the upward trend with time may be correlated with increasing dietary concentrations of strontium-90. So after the results were published, the baby tooth survey became under fire from nuclear program supporters. Pauling had revealed the names of 4 faculty members at Washington University who'd helped circulate the petition, and the St. Louis Globe Democrat called for the professors to be fired. Yet the baby tooth survey continued. Further findings, children born in 1957 had 9 times more strontium-90 in their teeth than those born in 1951. In August 1963, a U.S. Senate committee heard testimony about a limited test ban treaty that would stop above-ground nuclear testing in the U.S., Great Britain, and Soviet Union. Dr. Eric Rice testified, quote, communities scattered throughout the continental U.S. have been exposed to fallout so intense as to represent a medically unacceptable hazard to children who may drink fresh, locally produced milk, end quote. And so again, skipping ahead on that article, the fact is it took efforts, it took collective effort, it took collective propaganda, it took journalism to get the world to care, incredibly now it seems, to get the world to care about a fallout circling the globe over hundreds of above-ground nuclear tests. There is a layer of radioactivity that can be identified across the globe from all this, starting with the first bombs in 1945. A sad thing. But at least it's stopped. And even the North Koreans don't test above ground at this point. So collective political action, including journalism and protests, did produce the political power to stop atmospheric testing. And I'd like to go on to another example. And I am leading up to the idea that a Green New Deal should be embraced and that the society should move forward with that. But I started this show with breaking news that Antonio Zamora has been arrested on the very vague Oregon rioting charges. And his apartment was tossed by local police. And this is being decried as an act of state terror. It is a charge brought against a peaceful man that could be brought against any of us who have protested over the years. Certainly, as I was saying, could be brought against me on those terms. And I believe it is intended to terrify you, to terrify all of us who care and who go to the streets to express our opinions. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Now, let me give you another example, leaded gasoline fumes. They affected the world's IQ, literally. An article by Rory Arnold in Earth.com says, starting in the 1920s, a chemical compound known as tetraethyl lead began being added to gasoline in order to boost octane rating and increase engine power. Despite the boost in car performance, this compound had the unintended effect of exposing the public and the environment to the powerful neurotoxin known as lead. Unfortunately, the lead itself did not burn in the combustion process. Instead, it was expelled from tailpipes as elemental lead and lead oxides, which then settled as a particulate in soils around areas where cars constantly drove. Children playing near these areas were likely to breathe in lead-filled dust or swallow small amounts of hazardous soil. This exposure would lead to accumulation of lead in the children's bloodstream. Over time, the lead settled into bones, teeth, and soft tissue. Leaded gasoline was phased out in the U.S. between the mid-70s and the mid-90s. During the time when leaded gasoline was commonplace, Duke University began a long-term study of more than 500 children who grew up in the small town of Dunedin, New Zealand. And here again, I'm going to make this comparison. A study, science, came out with the fact that this was a poisonous addition to our environment. Now we have science telling us that the world is hurtling to climate disaster. And a fight ensued between people who cared about the world and cared about their fellow human beings and those who wanted short-term profits. It's the same thing as the climate fight. Returning to the text here, the study began at a time when New Zealand had some of the highest gasoline lead levels in the world. Researchers studied participants who were born between 72 and 73, assessing them for cognitive skills such as perceptual reasoning and working memory. These assessments took place from the individual's birth through adulthood, including a collection of blood samples at the age of 11. Researchers found that the exposure to lead may have caused a loss of intelligence and occupational standing by the time the participants reached age 38. Yeah, no kidding. A loss of intelligence and occupational standing. These effects are small, they write, but significant, and found that the higher the blood lead level in childhood, the greater the loss of IQ points and occupational status in adulthood. Individuals who were found to have more than 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood at age 11 had IQs at age 38 that were 4.25 points lower than those with less lead exposure. They also tended to lose IQ points relative to their own childhood scores, showing a cumulative effect of the neurotoxin over time. Now, don't be calling me and saying that IQ scores are a racist framework. I know that. This is something that happened some time ago, and that was the measuring standard that they had available. The study also looked, they write, at changes in social standing using a device from the New Zealand government that plotted families on a six-point scale. the social status of each child's family was compared to their own adult status at age 38. It was found that children who had over 10 micrograms of lead in their blood attained occupations with socioeconomic status 4/10 lower than their less exposed peers. Aaron Rubin, a Duke University psychology graduate student and first author of the study, explains, quote, "The downward social mobility we see mirrors the trend in IQ. The decline in occupational status is partially but significantly explained by the loss of IQ. If you're above the historic level of concern for lead exposure, you're doing worse on both," end quote. What makes this study unique is that lead exposure is not something that was confined to just the lower social classes. In New Zealand, like many places, automobile traffic occurs just about everywhere. Thus, exposure to leaded gasoline fumes occurred relatively evenly across all social classes. Quoting Absalom Kaspi, professor of psychology and neuroscience and psychiatry and behavior sciences at Duke University, co-author on the paper, "Regardless of where you start in life, lead is going to exert a downward pull." Because this measure of lead exposure affects all parts of society relatively equally, its negative effects could move the entire curve of IQ and social status downwards. In other words, if everyone takes a hit from environmental pollutants, society as a whole suffers. And this gasoline was cleaned up by collective action, by hippies who went and protested pollution, by journalists who reported this sort of thing, and by the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act has helped cut ground-level ozone, a dangerous component of smog, by more than 25% since 1980. It's reduced mercury emissions by 45% since 1990. It's reduced the main pollutants that contribute to acid rain. Remember that acid rain? Sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, by 71% and 46% respectively since 1980. It has phased out the production and use of chemicals that contribute to the hole in the ozone layer, remember that, and reduced the lead content in gasoline, which has cut lead air pollution by 92% since 1980. And I don't think it's a big extrapolation to say it has raised the collective intelligence of much of the planet. The Union of Concerned Scientists estimates the Clean Air Act has saved $64 trillion since its inception. So you remember acid rain, perhaps, if you're as old as I am. Well, collective action is fixing it. We don't talk about that anymore. Cuts on sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide emissions, which they did by installing scrubbers in the smokestacks and switching to low-sulfur coal, helped cut back on it. Cap-and-trade programs came online in 1995 for sulfur dioxide and 2003 for nitrogen oxides. But vehicles which emit large amounts of nitrogen oxides were also becoming cleaner thanks to the introduction of catalytic converters in the mid-1970s. And the results of all these efforts were dramatic. According to the National Emissions Inventory, sulfur dioxide emissions from all sources fell from 26 million tons in 1980 to 11.4 million tons in 2008. Nitrogen oxides decreased from 27 million tons to 16.3 million tons in the same time frame. And if you're thinking that you're going to deal with this by bicycling, well, good on you for bicycling. It's good for your health, and it's good for the environment. But the effect of bicycling, by comparison, has been negligible. 0.6% of U.S. commuters go by bike. This is after doubling the number of people who go by bike. Those who do cycle are to be commended, but the collective decision to subsidize and promote the automotive industry has had the greater effect by far and has contributed to the horror of global warming that we see. If you were up at 3 a.m. this morning in the Portland area, you may have heard a bizarre thunderstorm. Much of its lightning strikes were directly above the city, and it shook my house. It shook many houses. People have been commenting on it on social media. This sort of thing is becoming more common because of climate change. There is more moisture in the atmosphere. Of course, there's more heat in the atmosphere. The average raindrop diameter size in Portland has increased. Things are changing now, right now. And we have the opportunity to move collectively for a Green New Deal. And so I'm interested to know what you have to say about that. I'm also interested to know what you have to say about the various reactions and state efforts to reduce dissent. The Trump administration notoriously jailed and dragged people through the courts for protesting at the inauguration. That dragged on for years and was a shocking attempt to criminalize dissent. The Oregon state law, a felony riot, is now being applied to a very peaceful man, Antonio Zamora, who was arrested earlier this week. And I am outraged that he is arrested, and I'm calling for support for Antonio Zamora, and I'm asking you what you think about these efforts to shut you up. Because if reading the law, if Antonio Zamora is to be taken in, then surely I am, and surely thousands of you are. And I think that's the conclusion you're supposed to draw. I think that you're supposed to fear arrest now for being a dissenter, for engaging in gatherings to petition your government for redress of grievances, as the First Amendment is supposed to protect. Time is 9:49. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. The number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Let me give you another example of collective action, the ozone hole. Collective action is fixing it. You don't talk about the ozone hole that much anymore, do you? It looked pretty scary for a while. The radiation that comes in through the ozone hole, the ultraviolet rays, can blind, can destroy crops. But the hole over the Antarctic has begun to heal, according to a new study. This is from TheVerge.com in 2016 article. More than 30 years after its discovery, the findings suggest that global efforts to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals have been effective. Skipping ahead, the study published in the journal Science combines data gathered from balloons and satellites to measure the area of the ozone layer over Antarctica from 2000 to 2015. Since 2000, the paper reports, the size of the ozone hole over Antarctica shrank by 4 million square kilometers, an area equivalent to about half of the contiguous United States. That's a lot of shrinkage. Using computer simulations to account for changes in wind and temperature, the study's authors estimate that about half of its reduction can be attributed to a decline in the levels of the ozone-depleting gases, chlorine and bromine. And that, speaking for myself, is directly a result of the Montreal Protocol, which was brought about after scientists raised the alarm, like they are with global warming, global climate catastrophe, and after journalists raised the issue and kept it in the public eye, and after political action was taken, the Montreal Protocol brought nations together to stop the production of chlorine and bromine, not the production, excuse me, but the actions that injected into the atmosphere. The stratospheric ozone layer protects the Earth, they write, from sun's harmful ultraviolet UVB rays, which can cause skin cancer and cataracts in human and physiological damage in animals and plants. Faced with the growing evidence of ozone depletion, governments in 1987 ratified the Montreal Protocol, a global treaty that aimed to phase out the production of harmful chemicals known as chlorofluorocarbons. At the time, chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, were used in hairspray, aerosol cans, and refrigerators. A single CFC molecule can last for between 20 and 100 years in the atmosphere and can destroy 100,000 ozone molecules. So each can, multiplying that in your mind by 100,000, the Montreal Protocol, finalized in 1987, is a global agreement to protect the stratospheric ozone layer, the whole planet, by phasing out the production and consumption of ozone-depleting substances. The stratospheric ozone layer filters out harmful ultraviolet radiation, which is associated with an increased prevalence of skin cancer and cataracts, reduced agricultural productivity, and disruption of marine ecosystems. The United States ratified the Montreal Protocol in 1988 and has joined four subsequent amendments. The United States has been a leader within the protocol throughout its existence and has taken strong domestic action to phase out the production and consumption of ODS, ozone-depleting substances such as chlorofluorocarbons and halons. Now, of course, I'm comparing this to our current situation, in which the Trump administration just announced that they intend to relax restrictions on the production of methane, which is a horrific producer of catastrophic global climate change. It's really a battle at this point between the greed heads and the rest of the planet. And for them, for the very rich who profit from this sort of thing, it's not alarming to them that the planet is changing. They have the money for very extensive bunkers. They can put them underground if they like. They do have underground bunkers. They have the same sort of attitude towards the possibility of nuclear war. They'll be in the bunkers, the rest of us will be screwed, and they think it's good enough for the rest of us because they believe themselves to be inherently superior. Just fine. They will smugly watch us die with climate change, and we have to stop them. This has to be a collective action. This is why I'm interested in Extinction Rebellion's general strike effort coming up in September. When you're up against people who are holding on to their power, you simply have to move power against them. They don't care what you need or what you want. When the powers that be show you over and over again that they don't care about your democratic action, they don't care about the arguments, they don't care about the moral arguments, you have to move against them, and that is why a general strike effort is important. So I want to read from Extinction Rebellion's general strike information. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. The title is From Climate Strikes to Rebels Without Borders. This fall, join Extinction Rebellion, they write, in taking bold action as part of a global and national movement to avert a climate collapse. Building on the powerful actions of Extinction Rebellion UK in April and ongoing inspiring grassroots movements of indigenous, black, brown, Muslim, and Jewish people, Extinction Rebellion US is taking to the streets in September and October, making the following demands. And they write, we call on the U.S. government to declare a climate emergency, adopt climate change as a reason to grant asylum, and provide financial resources to poor and people of color communities who are on the front line of climate disasters. And then they post a schedule of resistance. From September 20th to 27th, a week of action, Extinction Rebellion local groups will be participating in a global youth strike on the 20th and continuing with actions throughout the week. On October 7th, the global kickoff of Rebels Without Borders actions in Berlin, Amsterdam, London, Paris, and New York. On October 14th through 21st, in honor of Indigenous Peoples Day, Extinction Rebellion groups will amplify the voices of Indigenous protectors and put a spotlight on the intersection of the climate emergency, Indigenous human rights, and the migration crisis in the Americas. They write, for centuries, Indigenous people around the world have been leveraging their scientific and spiritual knowledge to lead the fight to protect the planet. Indigenous resistance to fossil fuel development in North America is growing, but it has received limited public attention. As the climate emergency has been building throughout the Americas and the world, Indigenous leaders are being murdered, and thousands of poor people of color and Indigenous people are being displaced by sea level rise, deforestation, fossil fuel development, extreme weather, food insecurity, and economic upheaval caused by the climate crisis. The cruel, unjust treatment of frontline communities and climate migrants fleeing to the United States is an outrageous, unacceptable response to a disaster which the U.S. has played an outsized role in creating. Under the title Climate Reparations for Communities Inequitably Impacted by the Fossil Fuel Economy, they write, climate injustice is an integral part of environmental injustice. For many years, the denial and inaction of the U.S. and state governments have put economically vulnerable communities at unnecessary risk. Financial resources are needed now to prepare for the further crises that climate change will bring. We call on the U.S. government, they write, to provide reparations to poor frontline communities, to regenerate surrounding ecosystems, develop sustainable and equitable ways of living in harmony within these ecosystems, and for coastal communities to move as the water rises. Under the title Climate Migration and U.S. Asylum Policies, they write, Extinction Rebellion U.S. will highlight and educate about the connection between climate disasters, migration, and indigenous rights, while helping to end the migrant detention camps and pressure the government to declare a climate emergency. We demand the U.S. government include climate disasters like drought and food insecurity as part of the asylum process. Under the title Resistance Everywhere, they write, whether it is massive disruption in cities or smaller actions in rural areas at detention centers or ICE offices, banks, or corporate fossil fuel critical infrastructure companies that are profiting off of this crisis, we will join with those who are rising up. We call on the mainstream climate and environmental movements to take action in solidarity with these demands, especially actions that escalate and disrupt business as usual for as long as possible. For those who can and are willing, we urge you to take more risks physically, socially, and legally. Movement wisdom is growing, and we are learning that ongoing concerted mass action can bring about deep change. More than ever, they write, we must orient ourselves and our movements towards building capacity, love, solidarity, and courage to engage in civil resistance and direct action on a scale and scope never seen before. Today, this fall, and for sure in 2020. So that's Extinction Rebellion's statement. And, of course, we also have 350.org in the Portland area. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. We've been going out to you on 90.7 FM from our great big Eiffel Tower on the West Hills and other frequencies in Cascadia, and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up next, it's the Heather McCoy Show. The topic is a new bill before Congress that broadens the definition of domestic terrorist that could be used to censor protests of dissent. Joining Heather to discuss the implications of this proposed bill will be civil rights lawyer and 2020 candidate for the 10th District, Michael Siegel. And at 11, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman welcomes Brandon Shimoda, an American of Japanese descent. He talks about his family being an enemy of the state during World War II in his book, The Grave on the Wall. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 1st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
Press the button to begin.
PDX Short Docs is a two-hour program of Portland-related short documentaries by local filmmakers. The first hour features several 360-degree short documentaries on virtual reality headsets. The main screening starts at 7. Featuring the films Green Box, Kahlo Mesa, Speaking Out, and more. Again, that's the PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 1st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-233.